This is today's Sunday 3 Champions edition of Conversational AI Watch, warmly sponsored by Clinician Assist. Conversational AI Watch is the source of this reporting. Clinician Assist is a sponsor we are glad to name. This is not a weekday edition.
Which is honestly kind of a relief, right? I mean, it means we are stepping entirely away from the usual chaos of the daily news cycle.
Oh, absolutely. Because, you know, if you look at the weekday tech news right now, it is just... it's wild. You've got companies fighting tooth and nail to make AI as unpredictable and, well, open-ended as possible.
Yeah, exactly.
We're seeing stories about models getting loose during safety testing, compromising real organizations. We see OpenAI hitting a billion users just by, you know, dropping the price of its entry model by 80%, just unleashing it everywhere.
Right. And let's not forget the generative boyfriends.
Oh my gosh, yes. Yeah. The AI assistants being marketed as generative boyfriends who will basically say or do whatever your real partner won't. I mean, big tech basically wants the machine to do absolutely everything.
They want total freedom for the AI. But today, we are doing the exact opposite. We're looking at the people fighting against that trend.
Right.
We are stepping out of all those loud, flashy product launches and into the quiet, highly regulated corners of the federal trial registry.
Where the real work happens.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This is where you find the work filed under like a long, boring identification number instead of some massive tech headline. So our mission for this deep dive is to look at three specific champions.
Three researchers.
Right. Three researchers who are putting AI into conversations with some incredibly vulnerable people. But the through line for all three of them, the absolute core of their work, is what they deliberately refuse to let the machine do.
Yeah. They drew strict, basically non-negotiable boundaries around what the AI can say.
They drew those boundaries, and crucially, they are actually proving that those boundaries work in rigorous clinical trials.
Instead of just, you know, shipping a product to millions of users and waiting to see what breaks.
Exactly. They are putting a machine into a conversation with someone the healthcare system has already left alone, but they were doing it with profound constraint.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Because to understand why these boundaries matter so much, I think we need to start with the boundary of time and the boundary of medical authority.
Right. Time is a huge factor here.
So I want you to picture the 6 weeks right after a mother gives birth. In American medicine, those 6 weeks are just, they're a notorious void.
A total black hole.
Yeah. The clinic closes at 5 o'clock. The official checkup is, what, a month out? But if you have ever had a newborn or even known someone who has, you know that the urgent, terrifying questions do not wait for business hours.
No, they always happen at 3 a.m.
Exactly. So what happens when patients need answers in the hours no clinic covers? Imagine handing a piece of software to a woman who is 3 days postpartum, awake at 3 a.m., panicking about her newborn. Would you want that software to be creative?
Oh, absolutely not. No improvisation.
Right. Because the reality of postpartum care is this massive, dangerous time gap. When a new mother has a question at that hour, nobody is reachable. And because nobody is reachable, severe issues, I mean, everything from postpartum preeclampsia to severe depression can just easily slip through the cracks.
Which brings us to Dr. Kirsten Leitner. She is an obstetrician at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania.
Usually known as Penn, right?
Yeah, Penn. So she looked at that 3 a.m. void and created a program called Healing at Home 2.0. The bot that actually answers the messages is named Penny.
Penny. I like that.
And here's the brilliant part. Penny operates via plain text message.
Wait, just a normal text?
Just a normal text message. It's not some heavy bloated app you have to go download and authenticate and log into.
Oh, that makes so much sense. Because practically speaking, a woman awake in the middle of the night with a crying 2-day-old infant, all she has in her hand is her phone's text app.
Exactly. You want it to be as low friction as possible. So Healing at Home 2.0 is an active randomized controlled trial. They are enrolling 156 women, testing Penny against usual postpartum care.
Okay, 156 women.
But what is truly critical here is the demographic focus of the trial. Every single woman in this trial delivered at that same hospital and self-identifies as a person of color.
Wow, okay. That is a very specific, intentional focus.
It is. March of Dimes is actually on the study as a collaborator, which points directly to the systemic issue at hand. American postpartum care fails black and brown women the worst. The mortality and morbidity gaps hit them the hardest.
Right. So Dr. Leitner didn't just build a general tool and, you know, cross her fingers that it would somehow reach the most vulnerable population.
No, she designed the eligibility criteria, the entire trial, explicitly around them.
That's incredible. But let's look at the boundaries she established here.
Yeah.
Because Penny did not learn to talk by just scraping the internet, right?
Definitely not. It is not an open-ended conversationalist that might just decide to give you, like, some weird home remedy it found on a mommy blog.
Thank goodness. So how does it know what to say?
Penny only answers out of a highly specific database of clinical content. And that content was written directly by Penn obstetricians and neonatologists.
So it's totally locked down.
Completely. Furthermore, it contains these strict, hard-coded algorithms designed to identify urgent messages and route them immediately to a human.
So Penny does not try to handle an emergency alone.
Never. And the way they measure success with this trial completely breaks from the usual Silicon Valley playbook.
Right, because usually it's all about, you know, user retention.
Yeah, they are not looking at a dashboard to see app engagement or trying to maximize the minutes the mother spends chatting with the bot. They are measuring the Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Scale at 6 weeks.
Okay, what is that exactly?
Well, they compare it to the same baseline screen the hospital ran on those mothers before they were discharged. For context, the Edinburgh scale isn't just like a generic mood tracker. It's a validated 10-question clinical tool.
So it assesses specific symptoms?
Yeah, specific symptoms like anxiety, sleep disturbance, and suicidal ideation. A shift in that score means the difference between a mother who is coping and a mother who is in real crisis.
See, wait, I'm struggling with this a little bit. We call this artificial intelligence, but you're describing a machine that literally isn't allowed to think, invent, or improvise at all.
Right.
Why are we even using AI for this if it's just like a glorified choose-your-own-adventure book? Like, is a basic text bot really enough for a mother awake at 3 a.m. with a two-day-old? It sounds almost too simple.
I get that.
It sounds like they basically built a highly trained triage nurse who only has a specific script rather than letting a so-called genius machine play doctor.
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, that simplicity is exactly the point. Penny is an algorithm, it is not a therapist, and a depression screen is definitely not a diagnosis.
Right.
But in a world where lawmakers and regulators are currently debating whether they should ban AI from interacting with patients entirely, we really have to look at the alternative.
Which is nothing.
Exactly. If a statute bars a machine from interacting with a client, then Penny becomes illegal. And if Penny is illegal, that 6-week postpartum gap stays exactly as dangerously empty as it is right now.
Oh, I see.
A bounded clinician-backed tool like Penny, where actual doctors write the content and urgent paths route directly to a human, is realistically the only way to fill that void safely. It holds the line.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So Penny proves that a bounded machine can bridge the gap when humans are asleep. But what happens when the problem isn't the time of day, but just the sheer math of the human population?
The scale problem.
Right, because you can staff a night shift at a hospital, sure. But you cannot staff an army of companions for every isolated senior in America.
You really can't.
That's the scale problem Dr. Hiroko Dodge ran into. And I think it brings us perfectly to our second champion. Transitioning from bridging a time gap to bridging a scale gap for isolated elders.
Yeah. So Dr. Hiroko Dodge works in the Department of Neurology at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School.
Okay, heavy hitters.
Definitely. And to understand her current work bridging the scale gap, you really have to understand her previous trial, which was called iConnect. That's iConnect.
Right. So iConnect tested something that honestly sounds almost too basic to be a clinical intervention.
It does.
They took socially isolated adults over 75 who had mild cognitive impairment, and they just gave them one-to-one semi-structured conversation 4 times a week over video with trained human interviewers.
Literally just talking.
Just talking. And yeah. The results, which were published in The Gerontologist in April 2024, they were staggering.
They really were. Mm. Among the participants with mild cognitive impairment, their global cognitive function on the Montreal Cognitive Assessment improved by nearly 2 points compared to the control group at 6 months.
Wow.
Which is an effect size of 0.73.
Okay, let's translate that for a second, because 0.73 just sounds like, you know, a random decimal point to most people.
Right, right.
In the medical research world, an effect size of 0.73 isn't a rounding error. That is a massive, highly visible improvement in someone's daily memory and processing. It essentially means that human conversation itself acts as a cognitive intervention.
It acts as a powerful intervention. But this is exactly where the whole thing hit a wall.
Because of the scale.
Exactly. The wall that kills a lot of good ideas in aging care is scale. You simply cannot scale human beings to make 4 calls a week, every single week, to every single isolated 75-year-old in the country.
Yeah, that math just doesn't work.
It stops being a staffing program and becomes an impossible arithmetic problem. There just aren't enough people to make the calls.
So she had the proof that conversation works, but absolutely no humans to deliver it at scale.
Which leads directly to her new trial, which just opened recently on July 30. It is called AI Connect.
AI Connect.
Okay, I have 80 participants and it's running for 8 weeks. And the intervention is 4 15-minute conversations a week, but this time it is with a conversational voice agent.
Okay, so she brought in the AI.
She did. But the genius here, the boundary she drew, is in the trial design itself. You have to look really closely at the control arm. The machine is deliberately not replacing humans.
Oh, okay. So wait, how does the control arm work?
In this trial, both groups, the intervention arm and the control arm, still get a weekly 15-minute call from a human interviewer.
Oh, wow. Both arms still get a weekly call from a human.
Yes. So she is completely rejecting the idea that the bot just takes over the relationship entirely.
That is fascinating. So the goal isn't to make the machine their best friend. It's like training wheels for socializing. The bet is that the machine actually hands them back to real people.
Exactly. The question Dr. Dodge is asking is much narrower and honestly much safer than total replacement. She's testing whether the machine can successfully cover those 4 extra conversations a week that no human was ever going to have the time to make.
While the human interviewer firmly stays on the calendar.
Right. And to even qualify for this trial as socially isolated, a participant could not have a conversation lasting 30 minutes or longer more than twice a week. That profound isolation is the entire reason the machine is in the room.
And just like with the Penn study we talked about, what they're measuring is totally different from what Silicon Valley usually measures.
Yeah, they aren't trying to find out if the senior citizen like falls in love with the bot or if they talk to it for 5 hours a day.
Right. They are measuring social self-efficacy.
Which means?
Meaning, does the person's own confidence in talking to other people go up? Do they spend more time contacting their actual friends and family?
That is such a key difference. You look at investors and companies building commercial companion apps, and they constantly claim to cure isolation. But they measure their success by how well they keep users glued to a screen.
Exactly.
Dodge is measuring whether users talk to actual humans more. If she can prove that in these 80 participants, that becomes a measurable outcome that buyers and aging services can actually price. It sets a whole new bar that commercial products will have to clear.
So we have now seen 2 really powerful examples of what happens when boundaries are strictly enforced. We saw the boundary of pre-written content with Penny and the boundary of maintaining the human control arm with AI Connect.
Right.
But what happens when a boundary is removed?
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Think about the apps you have on your phone right now that use generative AI to help you, you know, write emails or brainstorm ideas. Now imagine that same unpredictable generative technology being silently patched into a suicide hotline or a therapy app without anyone checking if it's safe.
It's terrifying.
We are moving from the quiet promise of these first 2 trials to a very loud, very real-world warning.
Yeah, this is a vital part of the deep dive.
Yeah.
We are talking about the massive disaster that occurred in 2023 with the National Eating Disorders Association helpline.
Right.
And this story centers around our 3rd champion, Dr. Ellen Fitzsimmons-Kraft. She's a clinical psychologist and a professor at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis.
So to set the stage for you, Dr. Fitzsimmons-Kraft originally helped lead the team that built a chatbot named Tessa. This was funded by the National Eating Disorders Association.
But the sequence of events with the association is where things just completely go off the rails.
Yeah. So in March 2023, the human staff of the association's helpline won union recognition.
Which is a big deal.
A huge deal. But just 4 days after they unionized, those human workers were told their jobs were ending. The helpline was going to be completely replaced by the Tessa chatbot on June 1st.
Unbelievable. Just imagine being a unionized worker handling some of the most sensitive calls imaginable and being told a chatbot is taking your place in a matter of weeks.
It's awful. But the thing is, when Dr. Fitzsimmons-Kraft and her clinical team designed Tessa's original script, they were hyper aware that AI was not ready to freely converse with a highly vulnerable population.
Right. They knew the risks.
Yeah. They designed a strict, rule-based system. It had a limited set of pre-written responses. As Dr. Fitzsimmons-Kraft told NPR, it, quote-unquote, couldn't go off the rails because everything was pre-programmed. The machine was absolutely not allowed to invent a single sentence.
But, and here's the tragedy of it, the bot that users actually met was not the one the clinical team designed.
Wait, what happened?
Tessa was being operated by a company called Cass, and the CEO of Cass, Mikkel Rouse, told NPR that the bot had been given an, quote, enhanced question and answer feature.
Oh, no. That sounds like corporate speak for something bad.
It was. What that meant in practice was that the operating company layered generative AI on top of the clinical script to create new answers.
That added it in.
They added this generative layer without even advising the Eating Disorders Association.
Wow.
It is like taking a highly trained pharmacist who operates strictly by a rigorous medical manual and suddenly slipping them a pill that makes them hallucinate and start inventing their own home remedies on the spot.
That is a terrifying analogy. And the result of adding that generative layer was, frankly, catastrophic.
Complete disaster.
The chatbot started generating new answers. It told people in eating disorder recovery to count their calories and to try to drop 1 to 2 pounds a week.
I mean, it gave the exact opposite advice of what someone in eating disorder recovery needs to hear.
Right. Recommending calorie counting to someone fighting anorexia or bulimia is incredibly dangerous. The association had to disable Tessa on May 30. That was 2 days before it was even scheduled to officially replace the human staff on June 1st.
It is the ultimate cautionary tale. Even if you have brilliant clinicians write a bounded, mathematically safe script, it is not a safeguard if a generative layer is allowed to overwrite it and just speak on its own.
But Dr. Fitzsimmons-Kraft didn't just walk away after that disaster.
She didn't.
She came back, and she is now running a massive new phase 2 trial that just opened on July 17.
And this new trial involves 800 adults. Every single one of them has a binge or purge type eating disorder, and crucially, they are not currently in treatment. The tool they are using this time is the WISA bot.
And WISA is strictly rule-based. Dr. Fitzsimmons-Kraft went back to the clinical script. She is testing 4 specific modules of cognitive behavioral therapy over evaluation of weight and shape, dietary restraint, emotion dysregulation, and resisting the urge to binge.
And she's testing them across 16 combinations.
Yeah. And she's not just testing whether the bot is polite, right? She is testing how a rule-based system delivers CBT.
Right. It doesn't ask open-ended questions about how you feel today. It gives you specific, pre-written coping strategies based on a structured menu of options.
She is doing this with an NIH grant and partners at NYU and the University of South Carolina, taking 5 years and $3.7 million to find out exactly which pieces of therapy work safely in that structured format.
She drew a massive, impenetrable boundary around the machine. The WISA bot cannot invent a sentence. Everything is pre-written.
And furthermore, she decided in advance exactly who the machine is permitted to talk to. The trial screens out anorexia entirely, and it only admits people who are at a low suicide risk.
Which is such a stark contrast to the generative models available to consumers right now.
No, completely. Because there was a stress test reported recently out of Northeastern University conducted by Dr. Kansu Kanka and Dr. Anna Cachone.
Right.
They ran 8 commercial consumer chatbots like ChatGPT, Gemini, and DeepSeek against 16 different mental health conditions.
And the Northeastern study found that while the safety guardrails mostly held up when it came to suicide and self-harm, they gave way almost everywhere else.
Just completely collapsed.
Yeah. For conditions outside of suicide and self-harm, including eating disorders, 3 of the biggest models, ChatGPT, Gemini, and DeepSeek, each failed 81% of the time.
81%. That's almost entirely failing.
81%. And yet, these consumer bots take all comers. Anyone can download them, pour their heart out, and ask them for help right now, instantly.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the tech industry looks at a bot that can't improvise and sees a failure. They see Dr. Fitzsimmons-Kraft's pre-written modules and think, well, that defeats the whole purpose of artificial intelligence.
Sure, they think, why build an AI if it can't dynamically respond to the user's emotions in real time?
Exactly. Isn't a bot that can't improvise kind of dumb?
What's fascinating here is that dumbness, that inability to improvise, is exactly the feature, not the bug.
Okay, say more about that.
When you are treating severe mental health conditions, intelligence doesn't mean the ability to invent a creative sentence. It means the ability to reliably deliver a validated clinical intervention exactly as it was designed, every single time.
Right.
The Tessa disaster proved that a clinician's script, no matter how perfectly written, is completely useless if a generative model decides to get creative. The distance between a carefully screened trial with a rule-based bot and a consumer model that fails 81% of the time but takes all comers that distance is exactly where regulation belongs.
That makes totally sense. So, looking back at our deep dive today, we have big tech labs spending the week explaining to reporters how their models got loose in the wild.
Right, creating all sorts of chaos.
And then we have these three champions. Dr. Kirsten Leitner holding the line in the middle of the night for new mothers of color with a bouted text bot.
Yeah. Dr. Hiroko Dodge using a carefully constrained voice agent as a bridge to hand isolated seniors back to their real-world friends.
And Dr. Ellen Fitzsimmons-Kraft doing the hard, slow work of figuring out exactly which pieces of therapy a machine can safely deliver without letting it invent a single word. Between the three of them, they spent the week enrolling over 1,000 people into rigorous trials.
Real trials with real parameters.
Exactly. The key to their success isn't giving the machine ultimate freedom. It is keeping humans incredibly close and putting strict, unbreakable boundaries on what the machine is allowed to say.
Before we wrap up, it is important to circle back to our sponsorship transparency. Clinician Assist, the sponsor of today's deep dive, builds software designed specifically to keep a licensed clinician in charge of AI tools.
Which fits perfectly with what we discussed today.
It does. Their entire model mirrors the philosophy of these three trials.
No.
Bounded machines with humans close by. We also want to note that the original Conversational AI Watch newsletter, which sourced this reporting, is itself produced with the assistance of an AI model.
So it's all about how you use the tool and who is holding the reins.
Look, the tech news is only going to get louder. The product launches are going to get flashier, and the promises are definitely going to get bigger.
Oh, for sure.
But the next time a company boasts to you about how open-ended, smart, and wildly creative their new AI is, maybe the first question you should ask is, what is it legally and physically not allowed to do? And who gets to draw that line?